We have some special neighbors along New England shores, and they're moving in fast.
If we weren't trapping them right now, I can't even, they'd be walking the streets. They'd be coming down the driveway.
Green crabs. This invasive species growing in numbers here and across the country, and one solution is to drink them. I know, but wait. So here to talk more about this, Will Robinson, who is a distiller at Tamworth Distilling and Mercantile in New Hampshire. They've just released a batch of green crab-flavored whiskey, and Alicia Lumia, she is a founding board member of the newly formed organization greencrab.org. She handles marketing for Wolf's Fish, a wholesale fish company in Boston. Will, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Alicia, great to have you here in studio, too.
Thank you.
So, Alicia, I'm going to start with you. We heard a little sound at the top there from a short documentary by your nonprofit, greencrab.org, and I want to play a little more.
If we did nothing, they would overwhelm the estuaries completely, wipe out all the shellfish, and turn what used to be a very fertile ecological region into a barren kind of place. There were mussel colonies of at least an acre in size, if not 5 acres. I mean, they were big, 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 and they're just gone now.
So the estuary he's talking about, Ipswich, they sound alarmist there. Is this really what we're facing right now with an overpopulation of green crabs? Is it as bad as all of that sounds?
Unfortunately, it is. They are an incredibly invasive species. They are voracious predators. I mean, a single green crab can eat 40 juvenile softshell clams in a day. And so, and they reproduce at a really high rate. They compete with native shellfish of all kinds, from clams, oysters, mussels. So it really is quite a problem. It's a problem commercially for clam harvesters, for our oyster farmers who are fighting them daily, trying to keep them out of their cages and, you know, bring in their harvest. And they destroy the environment.
I want to illustrate this a little bit. There was a scene in the documentary where someone holds 40 of these juvenile clams, right? And they're the size of, you know, a large skipping stone, let's say. And then they hold the 40 clams that have reached the maturity age to be harvested and eaten. And it really underscores, if you eat the juvenile clams, they never grow up, which not only means you don't have them for later, but I'm assuming essentially cuts off the next reproductive cycle as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a problem, at least in farming, you have a hatchery, so you're able to repopulate and bring your new, like your juvenile oysters in. But, you know, it's decimating what you can do as a farmer. If you're losing so much of your crop early on, of course, then you're not as able to bring as much to market. In wild shellfish, it is cutting into the next generation.
So Will Robinson, who of Tamworth Distilling, when did you first learn about these invasive green crabs?
In my previous career, I was an environmental educator. Worked at an environmental education center on Lake Winnipesaukee here in New Hampshire, and we did a lot of focus on invasive species. So I was my specialty wasn't necessarily the marine environment, but I was very familiar with it. I've scuba dove in my past, so I was familiar with the issue with lionfish and the keys, and I've done some fishing as well, so the Asian carp issue that they're having in the Midwest.
Also invasive species.
Yes. And so the programs that have been started in those areas, you know, encouraging people to consume them, just kind of the natural next step. The more awareness we have, the more people we can get consuming them, maybe we can put a dent in these populations before they really are wrecking our ecosystems.
So, Alicia, for somebody who might not be familiar with invasive species, the idea that one of the best ways to handle them, and I've heard this before with other species like Will Robinson mentioned, is to eat our way through it. There's something about that seems so shocking. Is it? I mean, is it really novel to think to eat our way through the overabundance of green crabs?
I don't think it is. I mean, we're not used to eating them, so we don't think of eating them. There hasn't been a commercial fishery, but there's nothing particularly exotic about eating crab in general. It's an incredibly popular species. It's even very similar to a paddy crab found in Southeast Asia. So there are people eating crabs like this all over the world where they're native in Venice. They've been embraced as food for hundreds of years, and there are numerous, you know, inventive recipes using all parts of the crab. So we're a little late to getting on board with eating it, but You know, aside from it being an invasive species, it's also an incredibly abundant, delicious resource.
And my understanding is it is delicious, although hard to kind of pick out of the shell. I guess I want to ask you, okay, so as I understand it, we've had two different, basically varieties of green crab that have come to our shores, some as early as the 1800s. So why are we suddenly or relatively recently having a green crab problem that maybe we didn't have before?
The problem relates to ocean temperatures. You know, while they didn't have much as far as native predators, they had cold ocean temperatures that would kill off juvenile green crabs. So it wasn't so long ago that, you know, somewhere like Ipswich, those estuaries, they would really freeze solid for a good part of the winter, to the point where people could go out and ice fish on the Ipswich River. You know, there was really those hard, hard winters we're not getting anymore. And that was really our control mechanism since they've been here in the 19th century. And so, you know, even in recent years, when we've had a harder winter, the harvesters will notice, like, okay, we get a break for a year or so. The green crab population is down a bit. But at this point, betting on cold winters as a mitigation strategy isn't, you know, doesn't seem very promising.
Okay, so that's Alicia Lomea, who's on the board of directors of greencrab.org. We're also speaking with Will Robinson, who's a distiller at Tamworth Distilling, about the invasive species green crab. So, Will, coming back to you, it was intriguing that one might not only be able to eat one's way through this problem, but drink one's way through this problem. And you've got this green crab flavored whiskey. So, dude, I don't even know where to start, but maybe it's just with what made you think that was going to taste good?
Well, I have a little bit of a culinary background as well. I've done a lot of cooking professionally in my past, and I've always been intrigued by cultures that use certain ingredients that may be considered off on their own. For instance, in Southeast Asia, Vietnam and Thailand, fermented fish sauce is a very popular ingredient in a lot of their dishes. And that as an ingredient by itself is repulsive. You would not want And so crab, you know, can kind of be a similar sort of thing. I figured it could be a similar sort of thing. And I'm from the deep South originally. So I grew up cooking, doing, you know, a lot of Louisiana cooking and low country boil and those type of things. And so in researching it, I did a lot of research into the, you know, we have about a 300 year history of seafood spice blends here on the East Coast, different types of spices used, but there's kind of like a homogenous group of them that have been used continually on the East Coast for 300 years. And as I delved into that, you know, as a potential way of working with the crab, I was able to learn how a lot of these spices that are used in the blends were actually added so that they could curb some of the offense, what we consider offensive and consider offensive in a raw crab, in a crab by itself, you know, the aroma and the taste. And so ended up working with those spices to curb it. And I think it worked out really well.
All right. Actually. So let's pause there for a second. So you sent us a small bottle sample. It says right on it, Crab Trapper green crab flavored whiskey. It came in this little green metal crab trap, basically. And it's piqued quite a bit of curiosity around here at WBUR. And Alicia, I understand you're quite curious to taste it as well.
Very.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. I got a couple shot glasses here. I'm going to pull the cork off. I took the wax off before the show, but hopefully you can hear that now. While I pour it so that Alicia and I can get ready to taste it, Will, tell us a little bit about how you make it, and I'll be over here pouring.
Okay. Well, we, unlike a lot of distilleries around, we use a very kind of a highly advanced technological process called vacuum distilling. So we have some lab-grade glass stills that are able to operate under vacuum. And what that does is it allows us to distill aromas and flavors that might be destroyed under heat in a normal still, because you can boil at a lower temperature under vacuum, Boyle's law, et cetera. So I make a crab stock from the crabs and then remove the solids. Well, I clean them and make a stock just as if I was going to cook them and serve them.
Like a soup stock almost.
Right, exactly. And then I reserve the liquid, remove the solids, and I fortify that with some of our neutral grain spirit, which is kind of like a vodka. It's like our base spirit that we make to make gins and vodkas and those type of things with. And then we distill it in the rotovap, is what the vacuum still is called. And the distillate then is blended in with a 4-year-old reserve whiskey, bourbon reserve. Mm-hmm. you know, corn-based whiskey. There's a our whiskeys are very well. It is very corny, so there's a lot of corn there. There's a lot of nice barrel character as well.
Kind of an amber color.
Yeah, and there's some caramel and some vanilla and a little bit of maple that goes along with that. Off the top, if you were to smell the crab distillate by itself, you might get a whiff of what are called amines or amines, which are nitrogen-based compounds similar to ammonia. If you've ever noticed seafood, especially seafood that is bad, can burn your nose a little bit.
Yes.
So we use coriander as a spice for the top notes, and the coriander blends with those amines, and you don't even notice they're there. So a lot of people may, when they approach it at first, if they're not deeply familiar with seafood smells and the spices, they may not smell the crab off the bat.
No. All right. So we're going to take it back from you here. Stand by, sure. Because we have them in our shot glasses now. Alicia, smell it. And what do you think when you smell it?
I smell the vanilla and the spice more.
Yeah, the spice, the coriander, and whiskey. What I don't smell, Will, is crab. So stand by, Will. We're going to do this one at a time. You want to go first or second, Alicia?
I'll go first.
You're first. You're up. Go ahead. Take a taste. And what do you think?
It's delicious.
Yeah.
So I mean, the spice is definitely there, and I think you get a little... I can taste the shellfish on the back.
Okay, so my turn here. I'm going to take a sip. Okay, so first, let me just say it hits like whiskey, right?
It does.
That's my first, and it tastes like, and you're right. Okay, so when you first taste it, first you get whiskey, then you get spices, and then at the very end, you get a little bit of shellfish. Does that make you happy, Will, when you hear that that's the tasting experience here?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And instead of walking away, I don't know if you've noticed, but like there are some of the other spices in there are clove, cinnamon, allspice.
Yes.
And those are heavy oils that coat your tongue so that you finish with that instead of walking away with a marsh mouth, so to speak.
Yeah, that is correct. I do not have marsh mouth, but I do still have some of that clove, especially. I'm a big fan of clove. All right. So this is what's possible. Now, quickly, Will, how many crabs to make a batch of this?
About somewhere in the order of about 1,000, which is about 80 to 90 pounds.
Okay. And Alicia, you can't really tell us what the count of green crabs is, but what's the size of the problem we got to solve here?
Oh, that I don't know exactly, but in good news for seafood that we want to consume, it's something we don't have to worry about over-consuming.
All right, actually, Amanda gave us a cut from the documentary that helps us quantify that a little bit. Here we go.
Where we fish today in the river, we were averaging 50 to 60 30-pound bags every time we haul the traps. If you do that for 3 months, it's a lot of crabs. And there are a million places like that, and there are crabs in every one of the places.
So, Will, for you, is that, that's overwhelming, or is that, great news, because if people like this, I have an unlimited supply of my key ingredient?
I honestly, I knew that the numbers, we're a craft distillery. I filled every of that by hand. I blended it myself. I cleaned all the crabs myself. The scale is obviously, definitely an issue, but the awareness goes a long way. And I knew that I had a feeling between the ick factor and the environmental factor and just the kind of just unusual in the first place thing that it would be a good story. And really the more awareness that we can bring to these problems, the more minds we have working on it, the more we can do something about it.
So, Alicia, you're on the board of directors of greencrab.org, a relatively new organization dealing with this invasive species, but you also work at a fish distributor. Briefly, in the fishing industry, what's the conversation about green crabs?
For shellfish farmers and clammers, they're very eager to get rid of them. I mean, we're bringing in the green crabs now at Wolf's Fish to sell to chefs in the Boston area, and we've even started shipping them beyond. Chefs in South Carolina and in Delaware and North Carolina have been interested and are taking crabs, and we're starting to sell them online. We are working with a local harvester, and there are other local harvesters who are even bringing them into Boston for us for free just because they want to start making a dent in this population. And so they're very eager to do it. Some fisheries think of them as bait, but for tautog and for striped bass, they can be used as bait. But there's a lot of things that we've used as bait traditionally, like squid, that now are on menus everywhere. So I don't see why that can't be the same path for green crabs.
So from bait to eat.
Yes.
And well, I gotta ask you, you know, there is something remarkable about this entire story, including the fact that I'm drinking this invasive species. When you made your first batch and you went to taste it for the first time, I just gotta know, what was your reaction? Just quickly.
I actually filled a small vial with it and risked my driver's license driving around smelling it. I was not tasting it as much, but the aroma, just opening it back up and taking it in and thinking about it, because it was so there's a lot of depth to it. And I wanted to make sure. My impulse was like, this is good. But then I kept questioning myself because I didn't have a lot of input on it. Other input. So I'm constantly going back and smelling it. I still find myself, if I see an open bottle somewhere, I have to take a whiff.
All right, I'm taking a whiff right now. That is Will Robinson. He's a distiller at Tamworth Distilling and Mercantile in New Hampshire. They've just released a batch of green crab-flavored whiskey. Also here in Studio 2, Alicia Lumea. She's a founding board member of the newly formed organization greencrab.org, and she handles marketing for Wolf's Fish, a wholesale fish company in Boston. Will, Alicia, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.